Spirit 88.9 FM, we are Catholic Radio for the Christian community. Good morning, welcome to Spirit Mornings with Bruce McGregor and
Chris McGregor.
Today joined again by one of our favorite people in the world, Joseph Pierce, internationally acclaimed author. In addition to C.S. Lewis and the Catholic Church, he has other bestsellers such as G.K. Chesterton, Wisdom and Innocence, Literary Converts. I could go on probably for 10 minutes on so many more.
And he deserves it, Bruce.
He does. Joseph converting to the Catholic faith in 1989 as a result of, he says, becoming friends with several 20th century literary figures he researched who had been Christians and ultimately converted to Catholicism, particularly G.K. Chesterton. Joseph is a native of Britain, relocated here to the U.S. in 2001 to serve at Ave Maria University, then in Ypsilanti, Michigan. He is also a contributing writer to a number of newspapers and magazines in the U.K., U.S., and Canada, and now finds himself at Ave Maria University down in sunny Florida. And Joseph, good morning. Welcome to the program. We are delighted to have you back with us again.
Good morning. It's good to be back.
I hope you're having a fantastic summer.
Yes, very busy. I've had several conferences and summer schools, and I led a pilgrimage to England in the footsteps of the English masters and several literary figures as well. So that was great fun. But this is my first day back in the office for about 5 or 6 weeks. So it's been exhausting but exhilarating.
Well, the next time you have one of those pilgrimages, I hope you'll send us a notice, because that would be fantastic.
Well, I'd love to. I'd love to have you on board and have you come along so I can get to know you better. It's always nice to actually see the actual face rather than talk to people over the phone all the time. So it'd be great to actually get to know you better. So I'll certainly happily do that.
Well, you certainly have helped us to get to know some of the great literary figures of the last century, and just in the depth of your writing, and we just really thank you for that.
Mm-hmm.
My pleasure.
Today we're talking on the birthday of someone who I never truly appreciated until I read your book, Old Thunder, Hilaire Belloc.
Yes, that great hero of mine, I must admit.
I think it's so appropriate to be talking about him on his birthday, especially after I had reread Old Thunder. I read it a couple years ago, but I went back. Because the thing is, on his birthday, you realize that for this great man, there came before him some great figures. And when I talk specifically, I talk about his ancestors, and in particular, his mother and father.
Yes, indeed. What I love about Belloc is that he is really a giant figure that was born in turmoil, as you know, having read the book. That mm-hmm. He was born during, just as the Franco-Prussian War was starting. When he was a few months old, they had to evacuate the family home and flee to England. So he was born in turmoil, and his father, who, as you say, had a great and noble ancestry, died when he was young, and he was brought up by his mother, who herself was a convert to Catholicism.
I mean, her conversion, the thing about Bessie is that to understand Belloc, you really need to understand her, because she grew up in this time in Victorian England, essentially, surrounded by some of the great social literary writers like George Eliot and Elizabeth Glasgow, who's one of my favorites, and William Thackeray.
Yes, indeed. She moved in literary circles. She moved amongst the intelligentsia and very much as an equal. I mean, she was a formidable woman. And, you know, when you think about Belloc as one of the most formidable figures of the 20th century in terms of his powers of debate and indeed argument, then you see where he gets it from, because both his father and his mother were formidable figures.
Well, what I find about her so compelling is that amongst this group of literary elites that she's with, who have at best a Unitarian vision, at worst, I guess you could say they were agnostic, or the philosophy of the time wasn't it Alfred Comte from...
Comte, yeah.
Yes. And so for her to convert to Catholicism in the face of all of that, what the intelligentsia was, where they were going,
right,
was a significant paradigm shift.
Yes, and she was influenced, of course, to that to a great degree by both to the two great giants of the Victorian Church in England, Cardinal Manning and Cardinal Newman. So these great minds. And what I love about her is that she understood, as I said, mixed as an equal with these great secular minds, these great literary minds that you spoke about, under the influence of the the new philosophies that were leading towards agnosticism and ultimately atheism. And yet, she saw through that and cut through the cant of it, as it were, and was helped in so doing by those other giant minds that went against the grain of the rising tide of secularism, Manning and Newman.
The thing is about Old Thunder, which is just a wonderful book. It's more than a biography, Joseph, because when I read it, I felt like I was reading a romantic epic.
Oh, well, thank you.
Oh, it was. And I'm sitting there reading it, and when his father passes on, he's only 2 years old.
Yeah.
And for Bessie, that was a very devastating occurrence. I mean, of course it would be. I mean, they're newly married.
Right.
Essentially, and their children are so young, and then he unexpectedly dies. But it casts a huge shadow on Belloc, doesn't it?
You know something, something which I find intriguing, and I haven't really got to the bottom of, and I don't even know if it's possible to do so. But you know, it's amazing how many of the great Christian writers that I've written about, including, for instance, Tolkien, who lost his father when he was about three. Mm-hmm. And his mother shortly afterwards, and C.S. Lewis, who lost his mother when he was young, about 10, I think. I'm not sure what it is. It's almost as if that losing a parent sort of causes sort of some of these inherent and yet dynamic tensions, mm-hmm. the hurt and the suffering and the pain and the coming through the pain and the suffering and the sorrow to sort of emerge maybe somewhat saddened and yet wiser. I mean, I'm talking about wisdom even as a child, as one comes to terms and comes to grips with these things. It's an intriguing issue. You know, the number of these writers that did lose one or other parent when they were very young.
Mm-hmm.
And as regards your compliment about my Belloc biography, by the way, I do want to say something about that. I really feel that by the time I wrote my biography of Belloc, I'd done my training, as it were, with other books and cut my teeth on other books, and I was ready to take on what is really, to a degree, a tougher character in Belloc, because Belloc is abrasive, he's bellicose, he picks fights, he sometimes lacks charity, although he's a great mind and a great Christian. And so therefore he's not a straightforward person. And with someone like Chesterton, who's sort of saintly and cuddly, you can sort of just go with the flow and let Chesterton's own life, with all of its consistency, do the talking for you. But when you have someone such as Belloc, who seems to have inconsistencies or at least paradoxes in their life, you really have to wrestle with them to sort of try to make sense of it. And I think that by the time I started writing the Belloc biography, I had matured enough to do that. I think if I had started with Belloc, I don't think I'd have been up to the job, quite frankly.
Well, I just think each character came so to life. I mean, it was one of that point where in the beginning of the book, I was just worried about Bessie. You know, what's going to happen to her and the decisions and how she pulled herself together. And then again, she got whammied. I mean, where she had a 20,000 pound inheritance, which she gave to someone to invest, and that fell apart. And so she had a semblance of affluence, but then lost it all.
Right.
So then she has to take her children, and they go to a small town, and it's in the southern part of England, isn't it, Sussex?
Yes, Sussex. It's south of London. You know, it was near the coast, actually, where Stindon, where they went to.
Right, and so here you have this, and you painted in the book so well, this pastoral type of setting where a young Belloc, who, and we have to remember, we got to put ourselves at that time, there is no television, there's no radio,
right.
There's nothing, but there is something for a child to use, and that's his imagination. And poetry was a wonderful way. You know, we think about video games and all these other things to keep you busy. Poetry was really that tool.
Yeah, I mean, something which we've lost in modern life is space. You know, we have all this time-saving technology, yet we never seem to have any time. And we certainly don't seem to have any space. And I think that for a young boy growing up in Sussex in the 1880s, 1870s and 1880s, you said no television, no video games, also no cars.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so everything was horse transport. And he lived in I've been there, and it's a beautiful village, in beautiful hilly countryside. And he would have had is space and time, you know, to look at things, to take time with things, to contemplate things. And again, that is the seedbed for great art, great poetry, and great mind, and great spirituality. And I think all of that has been sort of squeezed out of so many people's lives in the modern world that they don't have the time for the important things, for the real facts of life that, you know, let's face it, when it comes down to it, the most important thing about life, indeed the purpose of life, is to praise God and get to heaven. And in our day and age, there are so many distractions that is often not lost sight of completely. And I think it was much easier for someone growing up in Victorian England than it is for someone growing up in the 21st century.
Now, Joseph, heritage was very important to everyone, particularly in that era, and that was no different for Hilaire Belloc, was it? I mean, he was very, very proud of his French heritage.
Yes, and the other thing you see is that another thing we've lost is that Belloc was rooted in roots. I mean, mm-hmm. He understood that he was the inheritor of 2,000 years of Christian culture. And as he said once, that, you know, Europe is the faith and the faith is Europe. Now, he qualified that. Of course, the faith isn't just Europe, mm-hmm. but Europe is just the faith. And if and when Europe loses its faith, it will crumble. And that's what we're seeing happening today. Because Belloc knew that, you know, there were 2,000 years of great art, great literature, great music, great philosophy, great theology that really, really combined together to define what Christendom was. And this is something that allows one to grow. You know, to look back at one's roots allows you to live and breathe in an atmosphere that's far, far deeper than just following the fads of the age, which, you know, that just means that you're out of fashion, you know, as quickly as you're in it.
Right.
One of the things that he was so known for, and I think what stopped him to slow down and really absorb everything he encountered, was he was a walker. I mean, he walked everywhere. He traveled, and he absorbed everything that was around him in those events.
Yeah, I'm going to be teaching a course at Ave Maria on a special topics course on Chesterton and Belloc this autumn, and I'm looking forward to it. But one of the books we're going to be studying is Hilaire Belloc's Path to Rome.
Mm-hmm.
You know, as an act of thanksgiving for the church, he was so taken by the renovation of his local village church in France that as an impetuous, spontaneous act of thanksgiving to God, he decides to walk to Rome. You know, you're talking hundreds and hundreds of miles and right over the top of the Alps. And he does it. And the book that he writes is an absolute classic of modern Christian literature.
Well, he, in this zeal to just go and pilgrim, I mean, that's what he seems to do. He just, especially when he needs to get away or if he needs to travel. I don't want to skip over his the love of his life, Elodie, who his wife, who was an American that he met, and he actually, as a young man, ended up making that great pilgrimage to go collect her in California, and was turned away.
Yes, I mean, one of those great romantic courtships. You know, one has these romantic notions of the Wild West in the sort of 1890s, and that's when Belloc traveled all the way from England, ostensibly to visit relatives in Philadelphia. But in actual fact, in order to go and propose to Elodie, and he traveled across the whole continent in the 1890s.
Yeah.
And only to find that she was convinced at that time that she had a vocation to the Sisters of Mercy, and she was rebutted. He was rebutted. And penniless then, he seems to have left, dejected and without money, you know, from the San Francisco Bay Area in the 1890s, with no money, about 6,000 miles from home, and seems to have walked most of the way from the San Francisco Bay Area to the mountains of Colorado.
Wow.
I mean, it's just a phenomenal in that day and age, and paying for his way by sketching the farmhouses and the landscape in pencil, and then presenting it to the owners of the farmhouse in return for bed and breakfast. I mean, it was really an amazing story.
It is. I don't think, you know, contemporary authors could not devise a romantic epic.
No.
As this man's life.
Right, exactly. His life is itself an epic. I will say one thing, by the way, just to make the conversation descend from the sublime to the well, not sublime. I wasn't going to say ridiculous, but that's probably not fair. But one thing I find somewhat uncanny is a couple of parallels between my life and Belloc's. I'm certainly not a great writer such as he, but I also happened to meet and fall in love with a girl from California, and subsequently married her. So I had that much at least in common that I am an English writer who fell in love with a Californian girl and got married. So I sort of cling with pride to anything that I have in common with Hilaire Belloc.
Well, the thing I think that's so remarkable about him, even after she turns him away, he goes back, eventually gets back to England, goes to, if I'm not mistaken, he joins the army.
He does. He does the equivalent. They used to say that spurned lovers would run away and join the French Foreign Legion, and mm-hmm. he didn't actually join the French Foreign Legion, but he joined the French Army because, of course, his mother was English, but his father was French, and so he had French citizenship, and therefore he went to do his national service in the French Army, and that was also a way of trying to, I suppose, literally recover from a broken heart.
Yeah, and then once he finally left the army, he ended up going back to England and attending Oxford.
Yes, and indeed he got a first class honours degree in history from Balliol College, Oxford, and one should say that you know, a first class honours degree from Oxford even today is something pretty special. You got to be pretty smart to do that, but, you know. But in the 1890s. Then it was something extremely. It marked you out as someone extremely gifted intellectually to walk away from Oxford in those days with a first class honours degree. And Belloc did get a first class honours degree in history, which is something we should bear in mind when anti-Catholic historians sort of criticise Belloc's historical works, of which he wrote many. You know, this man was a fully qualified historian.
Mm-hmm.
Help us to understand the significance of the order and why that type of oration would be such a standout in that period.
Oratory was more important then, I think, because we didn't have television, and therefore the way that people conveyed themselves was either in writing or through the spoken word. And at Oxford, Belloc was president of the Oxford Union, which is another very prestigious post. To be elected to that, and his oratory was famous. They really said that he could argue with anybody and beat anybody in a verbal argument, which of course set him up perfectly for his career in Parliament, because he became a member of Parliament as well in the first years of the 20th century.
Yeah, I don't, you know, I think if we think today that we go home, sit down, turn on the TV, and we listen to what we call political talking heads going back and forth, and there's such a plethora of them,
right,
to understand back in the 1890s that this would be the way of people would actually leave their homes at night to go hear someone or a number of people talk on different subjects.
And rhetoric was an art. In other words, that, you know, it's not like today where these talking heads really are conversationally inane mm-hmm. most of the time.
Mm-hmm.
You know, people were trained in the art of good rhetoric and good oratory, and it would be something to behold, particularly if you have two great minds with great rhetorical gifts arguing with each other about a central point. And at the end of it, of course, apart from being hugely entertained by the clash of two intellectual colossuses, titans,
mm-hmm.
You would actually come away with a far better understanding of the issue that's just been debated. Whereas often today, you know, it's all in sound bites, it's all in cliches, it's all in slogans, and people rarely get beneath the surface of an issue to really understand what it's about. And I guess a further example of the shallowness of modern life compared with the relative depth of the age in which we're now speaking.
Well, I have to, as the female side of this, I have to say for Elodie, she ended up pursue her vocation, or her, what they perceived to be her vocation at the time of entering the Sisters of Charity, but she was turned away after just a short period of time because it just wasn't for her. It turned out that she did have this deep love for Belloc.
Yeah, but she did have a vocation, but the vocation was to marriage.
Thank you.
Right.
And you know, and that vocation she fulfilled wonderfully. Not only because she was the mother of five children, and a very good and devoted mother. She also had to be the husband to Hilaire Belloc, who wasn't necessarily the easiest person to be married to, in the sense that he was always out and about fighting campaigns, political campaigns, literary arguments, and then, of course, his walk to Rome, where he was gone for 5 or 6 weeks on end, and on his sailing boat. I mean, he was often away from home, and she was left at home with the children. I mean, I would be happy for people to criticize Belloc for that, but the important thing is that Élodie, in a real saintly way, fulfilled her vocation, you know, not only the call to duty, but in many respects beyond the call of duty, because, you know, Belloc wasn't probably not the easiest man to be married to, and yet there's not one single piece of evidence of her saying anything other than good things about him. She loved him dearly, and he loved her dearly, and after she died, he wore black broadcloth for the rest of his life.
Mm. Yeah, the thing that I'm impressed, especially the way you write about him, is that he's a man who feels passionately, and I would imagine if he loved passionately, and the friendships that he had, he was devoted passionately.
Well, there's a story which is certainly true, because I've been to Belloc's home in Kingsland in Sussex, and after his wife Élodie died, he never opened the door again to that room. It was left exactly as she left it after she died, and every night he would pause outside the door and cross himself and say a prayer before going to bed. And bear in mind that she died in 1914 and he lived to 1953. I mean, this is 39 years at which he did this. He never stopped loving his wife, never married again. She was the one woman in his life.
Well, he was fiercely loyal to his friends, and in particular to G.K. Chesterton.
Oh, yes. I mean, there are people that love Chesterton that, for one reason or another, don't like Belloc. Amongst these was C.S. Lewis, who sort of believed that Belloc had a negative influence on Chesterton. And I know that that I've had people that reviewed my Belloc book that sort of have claimed that my saying that Belloc and Chesterton were really close is not true. And all I can say to that, and I did actually respond to that by saying that all you have to do is to look at, first of all, G.K. Chesterton's autobiography, which he wrote just shortly before he died. There's a whole chapter dedicated to Belloc and Chesterton's friendship with him, entitled Portrait of a Friend. I mean, there's no one else, with the exception of Chesterton's own wife, in the whole autobiography who's treated as lovingly. And then we have this wonderful poem by Belloc, Lines to a Don, sort of 40 or 50 lines of invective against the Don, that's the Oxford professor, the Don dared attack my Chesterton. and it's a really entertaining poem. I read it to my students, and they love it. And the other thing is, after Chesterton died, Belloc wrote a book on the place of Gilbert Keith Chesterton in English letters. I mean, it's one of the great, along with Tolkien and Lewis, the friendship between Chesterton and Belloc is one of the great literary friendships of the 20th century.
I think, as you quote in your book, that the Catholic publisher Frank Sheets said that there was Chesterton, of course, but then Belloc had so much to do with the making of Chesterton, and Chesterton not much with the making of Belloc.
Right, that's one of the most important tributes to Belloc, Frank Sheets' tribute, because it does actually show Belloc's importance, not only in his own right, but as someone who to a degree shaped Chesterton as Chesterton was moving towards the faith. We need to remember that Belloc was a cradle Catholic. He stayed loyal to the faith throughout his life. Chesterton was an Anglican when he first met Belloc, and from the first time that Chesterton mentions Belloc, which he recounts his first impressions when he first met Belloc at a meeting in 1900, it's quite clear that Chesterton had fallen under Belloc's charm, and Belloc knew far more about history and far more about Europe and far more about Catholicism, far more about the heresies that Catholicism had faced over the centuries than Chesterton did. And Chesterton learned so much of all of those things from Belloc, and also their political view, distributism. As Chesterton said of Belloc, that he was the master and Chesterton, was the disciple. So, in many, many ways, Belloc was a major influence on Chesterton. And one of my great campaigns in life has been to allow Belloc to move out from behind the shadow of Chesterton. I think that they deserve to stand shoulder to shoulder. That's how they stood in life, and that's, I think, how they should stand to posterity. Are two equals in the fight for Catholic truth in a secular age, and that's one of my goals in life, and one of my goals of that biography was to bring Belloc out of the shadow of Chesterton.
It's amazing when you look at, because of Belloc's stalwart adherence to his faith and his vision for it, as it always pointed him towards Rome, the ripples effect on how that affected Chesterton and Maurice Baring, and then ultimately that would affect Lewis, and it would affect, I mean, it just was this ripple,
right,
amongst so many influential thinkers and writers of the time.
Right, I mean, when I wrote my book, Literary Converts, it was clear to me that there were three phases, basically, of the Catholic cultural revival. The first was what we call the Newman period, period from John Henry Newman's conversion in 1845 until his death in 1890. And then there was the period of what I call the Chester Belloc, of Chesterton and Belloc, which was really from 1900, when Chesterton and Belloc first met, to Chesterton's death in 1936. And the influence of Chesterton and Belloc on their whole generation and the generations that followed is immense. And you know, it's arguable that we would not have seen the Tolkien and the C.S. Lewis that we know and love, and indeed other writers, if it hadn't been for the enormous presence and impact of Chesterton and Belloc in the first third of the 20th century.
You know, any conversation about Heller Belloc, you really have to see him as a real visionary as well, because he did foresee, as you put it in the book, the optimistic faith in scientific progress, which would lead to sheer darkness and strange things in the dark.
Absolutely. I mean, say, first of all, he saw, as you just quoted perfectly there, the inherent dangers of modernity and the destructive power of technology, particularly when there is no Christian philosophy to keep it in check. Mm-hmm. He saw that, but he also saw the renewed the danger of the rise of Islam. When everybody else thought that Islam was a spent force, Belloc in the Great Heresies made it perfectly clear that they weren't. And in actual fact, talking about the role of Belloc as a prophet, in the Great Heresies, he says that the last great Muslim onslaught on Europe was turned back by the lifting of the siege of Vienna, which happened on September the 11th. And he said that's a date that every Christian should remember.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, every Christian's forgot. But either it's a strange coincidence, or else the Muslim terrorists who attacked the Twin Towers certainly hadn't forgotten the significance of that day.
Just a fascinating thing. I know I've gone into Catholic bookstores in this area, and I see now, which I hadn't seen before, just volumes of Belloc's work.
Yeah, Belloc is on the rise, thanks be to God. I think that part of it is that he has been lifted by the renewal of interest in Chesterton. I was at the Chesterton conference in St. Paul, Minnesota last month, and there were 450 people at it, and when everybody was at one of the talks, the people had to sit in the aisles. There were no seats left. And
wow.
I went 4 years ago, and it was good, but this, you know, it had grown considerably since then. And when I first read Chesterton in 1980, when I was a teenager, you know, he'd been all but forgotten, except by a select handful, and all of his books were out of print, and you could get them very easily in secondhand bookshops because, you know, everyone had basically got rid of them. And now to see how many of Chesterton's books are back in print. And I think that one of the good things about that is that people, once they discover Chesterton, they very quickly discover Belloc. And many of his books are now back in print, I'm very pleased to say.
Yeah, I just think it's fascinating, as you chronicle in the book, the debates he would have with H.G. Wells. And that you can, to be able to turn around and look at history now and to see that, you know, in 1934, H.G. Wells is telling Stalin how wonderful what's happening in Russia.
Right.
And then to see, and unfortunately for Wells, he was able to live long enough to see that that was just a nightmarish outcome. But Belloc just stood very, very firm.
Yes, Belloc understood that philosophical materialism, of which Marxism, communism, is merely one of the results. I mean, Nazism's another, the French Revolution was another. that these things had led, even by Belloc's time, and would continue to lead in the future, which indeed they have, in the most barbaric and bloody period in human history.
Mm-hmm.
You know, as Chesterton said, when people stop believing in God, they don't believe in nothing, they believe in anything. So we've had all these strange gods, you know, the gods of Nazism, the gods of communism. And, of course, now we have the gods of selfish self-deification, which leads, amongst other things, to the killing of a million unborn children every year,
mm-hmm.
which we mustn't forget. I mean, which already means that basically in the United States we'll be killing more innocents than Hitler killed every 6 or 7 years. You know, so in other words, that Belloc saw that this golden age that that H.G. Wells promised, that, you know, that the science and technology would herald a new age where people would turn their back on religion and all other forms of quote unquote superstition and love science, and science would liberate them. That Belloc saw that was a load of nonsense, and of course Belloc's been proved right, and Wells has been proved wrong, and Wells himself admitted it. I mean, H.G. Wells's last book was called The Mind at the End of Its Tether.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he knew that his dream had gone up in smoke. You know, not only because of the abuses of Joseph Stalin and a mass murder of Joseph Stalin, but the dropping of the atom bombs on Hiroshima and Nagasaki, the birth of the Cold War. You know, that there was no golden age.
No.
Yeah.
No, but there is something that the work of Belloc did was point us towards a much more beautiful city in Jerusalem, and that's what we'll receive when we encounter God face to face.
Absolutely, the only golden age is heaven.
Yep.
And that's where we're all called to try to go to. And Belloc knew that's the central question in life, is getting to heaven.
Absolutely. Well, Joseph, I just hate it when I have to look at the clock and time is wound down on us. Fascinating discussion, Old Thunder, A Life of Hilaire Belloc, the book. And before we let you go, I would like you to impart the story about how Hilaire came to be called Old Thunder.
Well, he was born, again, this is quite interesting because it's almost a metaphor. He was born at the family home north of Paris during a thunderstorm. And so he was given the nickname Old Thunder. But there's two things that are very appropriate about that. First of all, it was as there was a thunderstorm growing in a real political sense with the German invasion of France.
Mm-hmm.
You know, literally, while Belloc was being born, this thing was brewing. And as I said, they had to leave the family home and flee to England when he was only a few months old. But also, of course, that nickname, given rather lovingly by his mother to him when he was born, was very appropriate to his character. He really was Old Thunder. He thundered through his life, hammering the heretics and defending the faith. And I really am actually very, very grateful to both of you for giving me the opportunity to celebrate Belloc's birthday in this way by just singing his praises.
Absolutely. Well, let's make sure we eat cake today, too.
Absolutely.
The best treat you could give yourself is to pick up a copy of Old Thunder, because it is... you know, everybody keeps telling me, well, what can I be reading? This is, even though it's a nonfiction book, it is one of the most beautifully written romantic epics I have sat down with, and I will go back and read it over and over again, because you fall in love with all of these people,
mm-hmm.
the way God must love them, with all their foibles and the mistakes they made, but yet their attempts to keep trying to stay true.
Well, thank you, Chris. That's... It always lifts my heart when I listen to you talking about my work. It makes me realize that there are people out there reading it that are appreciating it. It makes me feel great. So thank you so much.
Absolutely.
Thank you.
Joseph, keep on keeping on. Again, we're delighted to have you here today. Thanks, and God bless.
My pleasure, and God bless you.